light travels very fast, but it still takes time for it to travel. So that means when you're looking out into space and the light from some object in space comes to your eye, you're looking at that light as it left that object. So you're looking backward in time. That is, you may only be looking back 8 1/3 minutes, if you dare look at the sun, but you may be looking back 4.1 light years if you're looking at a very, very close star. Or you may be looking farther back in time as you look out into space. Because, see, it takes time for light to come to your eye, even though it travels very quickly. Well, this is an independent argument from geology. The second column, right in the middle. In 1857, Philip Gauss, published Omphalos, an attempt to untie the geological knot. Omphalos is the Greek word for navel, belly button, navel. Okay? Omphalos, can you imagine? Belly button, an attempt to untie the geological knot. But the title alone is striking. Philip Henry Gauss. Second line, he was a fellow of the Royal Society, an acquaintance of Darwin, an eminent naturalist with acute powers of observation, no undistinguished place among British naturalists. Then jump down 2, 4, 6, 8 lines. Faced with an ever-increasing flood of evidences for the great age of the Earth and universe, Gauss decided to use apparent age not as a stopgap where other arguments failed, that is, as others before him had used it, but as an overarching fundamental principle, the law of prochronism in creation. I'll explain that in a minute with some diagrams. Next page. Gauss based his thinking on two major propositions. The first was that all organic nature moves in a circle. A circle of birth, life, death, and rebirth. Well, you're all familiar with the cycle of nature, the cycles of nature, aren't you? With the result that for any living creature, any stage of its existence automatically bears the evidences of its previous stages. Then the second proposition, 2 lines farther, was that creation is a violent eruption. That is, not an eruption out of, but an eruption into. Creation is a violent eruption into the circle of nature. And therefore, all created living things must have possessed at the time of their creation all the evidences of a previous but unreal existence. These evidences being therefore effects which never had causes. Adam, for example, although never born of a woman, clearly must have had a navel. This led Gauss to draw a distinction between developments that were diachronic, those which occurred in real time, and those that were prochronic, being unreal developments whose apparent results are seen in organism at the moment of its creation. Now jump down to the last sentence of that paragraph. He suggested that the strata of the surface of the earth with their fossil floras and faunas, you understand floras and faunas, floras assemblages of plant remains, and faunas, that is in this context, assemblages of animal remains, floras and faunas, okay? That is in terms of the geology. That they may possibly belong to a prochronic development of the mighty plan of the life history of this world. Quote, hence the minuteness and undeniableness of the proofs of life which geologists rely on so confidently and present with such justifiable triumph do not in the least militate against my principle. This is from Gauss. The marks of hyena's teeth on the bones of Kirkdale Cave, the infant skeletons associated with adult skeletons of the same species, the abundance of coprolites, that is, droppings of animals which have then hardened and become fossilized, the foot tracks of birds and reptiles, the glacier scratches on rocks, hundreds of other beautiful and most irresistible evidences of preexistence, I do not wish to undervalue nor to explain away. On the hypothesis that the actual commencing point of the world's history was subsequent to the occurrence of such things in the perfect ideal whole, these phenomena would appear precisely as if the facts themselves had been diachronic instead of prochronic, as was really the case. Exactly the same, you'd find the same if they had occurred in real time instead of ideal time. He says they occurred in ideal time, and now we have real time. But if it had been real time back then, it would appear just the way it does. No difference in the way it looks. But what about the astronomical work of Herschel, indicating that the light from distant objects would take thousands, even millions of years to get to the Earth? Goss. Beautiful and at first sight unanswerable as this argument is, it falls to the ground before the spear touch of our Ithuriel, the doctrine of prochronism. He might be accused of waxing enthusiastic here. There is nothing more improbable in the notion that the sensible undulation was created at the observer's eye, the undulation, the wave, we call it today, wave, the waves, the light waves, were created at the observer's eye with all the prerequisite undulations prochronic, that is, an ideal time, than in the notion that blood was created in the capillaries of the first human body. The latter we have seen to be the fact. Is the former an impossibility? So God could have created the light waves that come to us from distant objects. He could have created them just before they reached our eyes, and they would look exactly the same as if they were in real time. But they were in ideal time, which of course means that in real time the universe could have been created one moment ago. One moment ago. Then in summary, Goss says, finally, the acceptance of the principles presented in this volume, even in their fullest extent, would not in the least affect the study of scientific geology. The character and order of the strata, their disruptions and displacements and injections, the successive floras and faunas, and all the other phenomena would be facts still. They would still be as now legitimate subjects of examination and inquiry. I do not know that a single conclusion now accepted would need to be given up, except that of actual chronology. And even in respect of this, it would be rather a modification than a relinquishment of what is at present held. We might still speak of the inconceivably long duration of the processes in question, provided we understand ideal instead of actual time, that the duration was projected in the mind of God and not really existent. The reaction was almost totally negative. Three lines farther, Goss's son Edmund, two lines farther, wrote, and the last line of what he wrote, but alas, atheists and Christians alike looked at it and laughed and threw it away. Amphilas. And he added that his father was plunged into deep depression as his prochronic theory failed to gain a favorable hearing. Next paragraph, 2, 4, 6, 8 lines. Charles Kingsley, for example, the Anglican clergyman, writer, and early supporter of Darwin, was a good friend of the elder Goss. Two lines farther. Kingsley, while never losing his admiration for Goss as a scientist, indicated that, I would not for £1,000 put your book into my children's hands, and wrote to him, if we accept the fact of absolute creation, God becomes a Deus quidam de captor. I do not mean merely in the case of fossils which pretend to be the bones of dead animals, but in the one single case of your newly created stars on the Podanus trunk and your newly created Adam's navel, you make God tell a lie. It is not my reason but my conscience which revolts here. Next page. First new paragraph. Amphilas was also reviewed by numerous journals. Three lines farther, the British Quarterly Review, for example, wrote, jump down four lines, Before we can entertain Mr. Goss's proposition for a moment, we must put down all human reason, his own as well, and adopt a supposition which is monstrous and desperate, involving lying geological appurtenances. Jump down 2, 4, 5 lines. The Westminster Review stated, jump down 2, 4, 6 lines. The thing is too monstrous for belief. The whole notion affords a lamentable instance of the degree to which the vision of even an intelligent man may be blinded by theological prejudice. And then jump down 2, 4, 6 lines. A review in the Geologist included the following comments, stating that Omphalos was unworthy of Mr. Goss, and indeed of anybody else in its doctrine. The world itself is thus like everything else made to offer a fallacious display of an antiquity it does not possess. Next paragraph. Perhaps the most penetrating analysis was that written in the Natural History Review, which compared Goss to Barclay, and agreed that, logically speaking, the theory was impeccable. Quote, we have no hesitation in pronouncing this book to be the most important and best written that has yet appeared on the very interesting question with which it deals. We believe the logic of the book to be unanswerable, its postulates true, its laws fairly deduced, and the whole considered as a play of metaphysical subtlety, absolutely complete. But the important question remains to be asked whether, after all this display of logical subtlety, the world at large will believe one word of Mr. Goss's theory. We are confident, so we think as Mr. Goss, that they will not. Pretty strong. Second column. The third, because there's a little paragraph there. The third paragraph of quotation, line 4. For ourselves, this is still the Natural History Review, we believe that a mode of reconciling all difficulties connected with the relation of the Bible to science does exist and may be readily found, which would not detract one tittle from the authority of the former, nor require of us to abandon the use of our reason in the investigation of the latter. The next paragraph, line 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. Goss continued to advocate prochronism in various letters and minor publications, but in his later scientific work, which includes some of his best, he's silent on the issue. No new champion of the cause appeared, and the concept seemingly vanished from sight. Down at the end, and then in 1961, Whitcomb and Morris published The Genesis Flood, and after the passage of over a century, the wheel had turned full circle, the philosophical corpse was disinterred, and apparent age was with us once again. Cleverly written there at the end. Now, before you jump, either on me or out the window, one or the other,
let me explain something, all right? I know I'm inundating you with papers tonight, but...
First, creation into the cycles of nature. Remember that creation is a violent eruption into the cycles of nature. Okay, that's the first basic principle of Goss. Now, what you've got here is, if you can think of cycles not as one circle that keeps going around the same circle, okay, that's not cycles. If you can think of cycles in this way, I can't draw this very well. Boy, I just had it. Better not try to do that. That's the easier way. That's very bad drawing, but still. You can think of cycles that way. Okay? Not cycles in the sense that you simply do this and keep going around the thing. That's not a cycle. That's a circle. If you can think of cycles that way, and you can think of nature, up in the left-hand quadrant there, birth, and then going around, following the arrow around to the bottom and over to the right, and you come past life and then past death and then back to rebirth. So the outside goes birth, life, death, rebirth, the cycles of nature, right? So far, so good. Now, what Goss proposed is that creation is an eruption into the cycles of nature. So the arrow, or hand on the clock, whatever you wish, creation that bursts into this cycle. at a particular point. And so from that time point back in the cycle of nature, you have ideal time, or what he called prochronic time, ideal time. And what you'd find when you got here in terms of creation into the cycles of nature, you'd find adult, mature specimens of plants and animals. And you'd say, hey, there's a history behind the plants and animals in terms of their development. And if you break into the cycles of nature, you have this birth all the way up to maturity. And here are animals and plants created mature. So you're breaking into the cycles of nature. From that point on, you have real time, not the broken arrow, but the solid arrow, until you come around all the way. Well, of course, it continues on. But creation is a one-time proposition. So this is in one of the cycles, okay, of nature. And God breaks into one of the cycles of nature, and what you have really is, that's where real time begins. That's where real time begins. Before that, you have only ideal time. And you can suppose anything you want in ideal time in terms of development from seed, say, or whatever, in terms of an egg, all the way up to a mature animal or a mature plant. That's the first concept, breaking into the cycles of nature. That's very important to catch that, to grasp it. Now, second picture, creation into Adam's lifespan. This is also very crucial for God. Here's Adam. How was he created? Not as a baby, not as a fetus, not as an embryo. He was created as a mature young adult. Okay? I like to think he was a young adult, okay? I might say middle age would be more like it, but more like a young adult, okay? Anyway, before that time, Adam had no real time. It was only ideal time. As though he had gone through all the stages of being an egg, embryo, fetus, all the way through. Being born, growing and developing as a little child, as an adolescent, all the way up to young adulthood. Then from there on you have real time after he's created. Middle age, advanced age, and then death. Real time. So Adam was created, that's an eruption into the lifespan or life cycle of Adam, one individual. And he's created at that point. So if you saw in Adam anything that would suggest a history leading up to that point, you'd have to say, since he was created at that point, that before that all you have is ideal time in the mind of God. You don't have any real time that took place. He insisted, of course, that Adam must have had a navel, which joined him through the umbilical cord to his ideal mother, to his ideal umbilical cord to his ideal mother. Anyway, now this has significant consequences in terms of the third picture. Now in the third picture, creation now becomes an eruption into geologic time. And you notice here that the time hand is moved around a little bit, only because as you go through these various eras, these great geologic eras, that real time only comes into play a short time ago, geologically speaking. So we've got creation taking place in the late Cenozoic. It starts with the Archaeozoic, then the Proterozoic, then the Paleozoic, then the Mesozoic, and the Cenozoic. Cenozoic from kainos, meaning new or recent, recent, and zoic life, recent life. And you notice that from the beginning of the Archaeozoic, which is the first great era in geology, that is the lowest strata theologically, all the way around through the Proterozoic, the Paleozoic, and the Mesozoic, and into most, or through most of the Cenozoic, you have ideal time. And it's only at the late Cenozoic that you have real time. So creation is an eruption into the geologic sequence of eras and periods and epochs. And so Goss said, everything before that, you can have it look exactly as it does look. That's all in ideal time. So in other words, creation, if you think about it now, if you're going to have ideal time with all those, quote, evidences of seeming antiquity, that means that God created the earth with all those evidences and all those strata intact. All the fossils in place, all the evidences of struggle for existence, all the evidences of animals killing each other and eating each other and so on, all of that, animals being born and animals dying, the whole thing, and different animals coming into the record at different times and passing out, becoming extinct, in other words, the dinosaurs in the Mesozoic era, and various, for instance, the trilobites in the Paleozoic era, all those things coming into existence, and you have the first mammals and coming into existence, and then the first primates and the first human beings and so forth. But of course, that comes in the late Cenozoic as far as human beings. Before that, all the fossils, all the strata are there, but they're in ideal time. God created them with the appearance of age. Now, Goss's attempt is a sweeping, overarching attempt, as Krauss's article said, not to use it as a stopgap where information fails, but to use it as a whole idea for explaining the concept of what you find in nature and what you find in Adam and what you find in geologic time, the whole thing. So it's really a full-orbed attempt to explain what geology presented at that particular time. And as Krauss said, it has come back with a vengeance in the writings of Whitcomb and Morris, the idea of apparent age, creation with apparent age. Ray.
What would they be giving up or whatever by holding that this is not the case, but there was, these things were not just in ideal time, but in actual time? What would they be? Why do they have a problem with that?
Well, of course, Krauss doesn't go into specifics, but Whitcomb and Morris use the apparent age theory as some of those people before Goss used it, as a stopgap measure. Because for the most part, the geologic strata were laid down before the flood and then were torn up by the flood. So that what you have now today, you have what happened at the flood, and all you can detect are the evidences of the work of the flood. You can't really detect what happened before the flood in terms of the way the strata were laid down, because the strata were all taken apart in the flood and then redeposited. And so instead of having a straight line history, you don't have that anymore. But where there are gaps in the argumentation, then this particular argument comes into play. It's not an overarching argument the way Goss used it in Whitcomb and Morris. Again, it's only used for places where it's needed, where the explanation doesn't suffice. That is, the flood explains all of the strata and all of the fossils. Jeff, did you have a point?
I was just thinking that if we say the flood destroyed everything, prior to this, then I would expect a much more random distribution of fossil records where they are found, but the patterns would be much less in sequence. Look like certain things were created before other things, and then the next time you look at it, it would be totally different.
Byron Nelson, in the Deluge story in Stone, suggests that that's exactly what happened. But the randomization took place in accordance with laws of density, so that when the materials which were in the strata, say the fossil materials, were redeposited, they were redeposited according to their density and specific gravity. And as a result, you have things which are found at certain levels because of that density, and certain other things because of that density, and so forth. That's the argument, at least, that Nelson puts forth. And he also adds to that, plus, you'd expect some of the things to be deposited in lower levels because they couldn't escape the waters, and then other things which could climb up hills and mountains and stuff, they would be deposited later on top. So they combine those two arguments. He combines those two arguments to get the fossils approximately in the right strata. But even where the fossils are in the right strata, however you explain that, it doesn't prove a problem because you can always fall back on creation with apparent age. You see? So wherever there are problems with your explanation, you have this to fall back on. It's an interesting business. Jenny?
So, this theory is saying that there really weren't no dinosaurs walking around the planet. This didn't really happen.
Walking around. Right. There were dinosaurs, but there were never dinosaurs walking around.
The only thing that actually the God ever did was dinosaur bones.
Let's say the remains.
Okay. Right. So the remains, God created, the fossil record.
Yes.
But there never was a dinosaur flesh eating trees and things like that.
Right.
So my question is, why would God bother doing this, setting up this whole scenario?
So we'd have something to fight with the scientists about. No, I don't think that's an adequate explanation. You only said that with tongue in cheek, of course. It's a good question. I'm not plumping for the view.
Even here, the critics of God's here talk about the deceptive aspects. Obviously, proponents of an apparent age model have to deal with these types of criticism.
Right.
To be relevant.
Right.
What you have is you've got a God of creation who is a deceiver, who has created a universe that lies, that tells them that it gives false information about it. And that seems to, I've always wrestled with that. Creates an earth with false information.
Right.
How you can see, make a statement that man might have discerned the glory of God.
Oh, I see.
Today.
I see.
You see what I'm saying?
And is inexcusable for not responding properly to that. Yeah.
Man's without excuse because Good. He can discern what Good. Has been made, the glory of God from what has been made. And yet, that model almost demands that man, by his best powers of observation, will fail to see the glory of God in it.
Yes, precisely so. Precisely so.
So my question in that line is, how have they responded to this kind of charge?
They have responded in this fashion. They have asked several leading questions, one of which, a very pointed question, is in regard to the second picture. They asked the question in regard to creation into Adam's lifespan. Was that deceptive? That is, Adam was created as a mature young adult. Was that deceptive? If we had been able to be observers, this is purely hypothetical, be observers at the time, would we have looked at Adam and then, based on our experience now of how life processes take place in human beings, would we have said, well, he must have passed through those various stages to reach young adulthood. And if not, then he looks like a young adult. Is that deceptive? And so they raised the question in that way.
Because anything that would be of miraculous nature is an intervention that is supernatural by definition, and therefore they don't allow God then to operate in that kind of a context.
So in other words, miracles would be deceptive.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, they come up to a conclusion. I mean, if they don't want to, not so much some miracles are deceptive, but I'm saying from their perspective here, to this idea of apparent age, miracles are just as deceptive in a sense. It's not so much a contradiction. I don't know what they do, how do they do with that whole area of
agreement. They said, well, this is what God did and the record is clear. I mean, Marsh and Wickham both argue that way. But this is what God did and there's no deception here that God created Adam as a young adult or Eve as a young adult. Although, looking at it, we would say there had to come a process before that to bring them to young adulthood. Stephen?
To me, the fact that, like, maybe the dinosaurs never existed in real time is a little bizarre, but the fact that if they didn't, that would somehow make the creation somehow deceptive. I don't really see that necessarily either. But I guess the thing that is sort of striking me as we're going through all this is that there's a lot of things, I mean, there's an awful lot of things that the Bible states that we can't comprehend at all. I mean, we just have to sort of accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And where we get into trouble is when we begin to just grasp little things
mm-hmm.
about a certain area, and then we begin to think that we really understand it, and then we, I couldn't say anything, are surprised. The fact that elements of it are still incomprehensible become a challenge almost. And you know, we have to resolve these things that previously we just accepted. I mean, we accepted what the Bible says, you know, by faith because we had no knowledge. And it's like the statement that says a little knowledge can make you dangerous. We're beginning to discover things about the earth and about all these things. And, you know, so we're insisting upon a resolution now, whereas, you know, hundreds of years ago, maybe
in the age of belief up to about 1600, those things remained pretty much unquestioned. I don't think we can remain in that or go back to that particular period.
So I'm not saying we should necessarily. I don't know. I guess the question is
I think your point is well taken, that we should not try to force reconciliations where they really shouldn't be made, and we shouldn't try to logically press everything into consistency in the revelation of God if there is no supporting evidence elsewhere in Scripture to allow us to do that. But as far as systematizing the data in Scripture, or trying to seek a correlation between the scriptural data and the data we find, you either do that kind of thing or you have to compartmentalize knowledge and try to set off your religious life from the whole of the rest of life. And I really don't know if that's possible to do indefinitely. Sooner or later, I think that's going to catch up. Sooner or later. And when it catches up, it may create all sorts of problems and doubts which wouldn't have occurred if you had tried to make the correlation when it was at the natural point of making the correlation. Now, again, that's very general and very hypothetical. And I'm not giving specific, concrete illustrations.
No, I understand what you're saying. It's not that I would say, like, I'm not saying it's better to just not deal with it and accept it. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah, right.
I guess what I'm saying is the fact that maybe in our effort to deal with it, we're creating our own problem. It's not that you know, God, to go back to the issue of the dinosaurs, if the dinosaurs never existed in real time, somehow make the fact that we would have trouble comprehending that, and that it might confuse us a little bit, to throw that at God and say, you know, this is somehow some conceptual thing. I don't know. I would say that maybe it's more our own limitations that would make us fear that way.
It does raise a question in our minds if we find dinosaur fossils in which, for example, in the stomach, or what would be the stomach of a dinosaur, there are remains of a skeleton of some other creature which this carnivorous dinosaur ate. Or if we found in the teeth of a dinosaur, if we found a small creature that was being devoured by a flesh-eating dinosaur, with the teeth marks on the bones of the small creature, or if we found in the stomachs of, woolly mammoths, we found various pollens and seeds and stuff, and then on all of those things would say, it's a matter of indifference whether we conclude that that's the way it happened, and this is evidence of what they ate and how they lived, as over against the way God must have created them in place with those pollens in their stomachs and those creatures in the dinosaur's teeth. If you find all kinds of evidences which seem to indicate that they went through struggle and this is the kind of things they did and ate and so on, it would seem that it's not an equal position to say, well, it could be one way or the other way equally. That is, you're pressed, when you get more and more evidence like that, it seems you're pressed more in the direction of taking those as actual evidences of living things that lived on the earth at a given time. It seems more and more difficult to hold back on that as the evidence accumulates. But I just throw that out. Well, I've gone over time. Forgive me. Next time, we're scheduled to deal with providence. You have the notes for that. I'll see you then. Oh! The class topic schedule, Thursday, December 13th, for Providence. And Providence runs all the way from 41 up to 61. Okay? Yeah. It is weird.
Is that really, is that the sum total of the argument, though? Is that based on the fact that the account of Adam suggests that he was created in a stage greater than infancy?
Yeah.
And so, therefore, if that is one example of an exception, then they can make an exception for
exactly.
All the rest.
Exactly, sure.
Those two things happen at one time, a split second here. The earth, the man. I mean, is there any period of time that God creates this, then in time, real time, God creates this? Or does this going from ideal time to real time, which includes man and animals, happen in the same exact time?
I think you have to be selective as far as the starting point. I mean, for instance, if you were to say, one moment ago, God created the light waves, okay? And the earth would only be one moment old, the whole thing. You have to be selective as to where you start. Do you start with just the moment before Adam was created? You know, where do you start? And that's selective.
I'm wondering how they fit that into Genesis. God did this, and then 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 God said, let us make man now.
All in ideal time. Until you get to man.
Happened simultaneously. Was the creation of man simultaneously with God?
I don't know.
One quick question I wanted to ask you, going back to the last class, about these creative aspect periods.
Yes.
When you view them, it's particularly in respect to your views, because I'm trying to understand the language that you use. When you view a creative aspect period, and God creates, okay, for example, particularly the cattle, and then has them go forth and multiply, do you view the creation of the cattle in a really large number? I mean, God creating essentially enough to populate generations worth. Same thing with plants and so on. What I'm trying to get at is, could there be aspects of immediate creation within a creative aspect period, where God may create a very limited number of individual organisms, and then because of his design and part of that creation, until he realizes it's good, he's allowing the immediate creation aspect to take place. Then we reach the essential fulfillment of what you identified, and he's looking back upon it.
All right, let me answer that. If we take this timeline and say, here's the beginning of this creative aspect period, and God starts to create a cattle. What I'm proposing is that God creates various kinds of cattle, not any given number. It could be just a few of a given kind. It could be one pair. It's not your main pair. Creates various kinds of cattle. These are immediate creations of various kinds. Now, what happens after he creates them? Can there be any development? Well, the interesting thing is that when it says God created, by the way, I like the way the NIV translates that section. Do you have it? It's very interesting. I looked at that the other time and said, boy, that's great. The way it's translated.